On this week's 51%, we'll hear from author and journalist Gail Sheehy about her memoir.
It's painful, but it's also illuminating.
Then it's off to France to hear about a man in a role traditionally for women. From there, we time travel to Eden. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. Gail Sheehy, author of The Influential Passages, now lays bare her own life passages in a memoir that reveals her path from groundbreaking 1960s girl journalist to best-selling author who made a career of excavating cultural taboos. Daring My Passages also tells the story of Sheehy's romance with Clay Felker, the creator of New York Magazine and mentor who inspired her to become a fearless journalist who gained repute for her in-depth character portraits of world leaders. Gail Sheehy is the author of 17 books, including Passages, named one of the 10 most influential books by the Library of Congress. 51%'s Joe Donahue interviews Gail Sheehy.
Was it always in the back of your mind, do you think, that okay, someday I will get to write my memoir?
It was never in the back of my mind. It wasn't until a friend began taking me out for lunch and dinner and pumping me for stories of my life. And finally he said, listen, you've turned 70. It's time to write a memoir. And it was a surprise to me to even think about it. But once I started it, I realized I had no idea how to do it. I had to take a course because it's more like writing a novel, but it's about real people.
Is it hard to put the magnifying glass on yourself to look at stages of your life and give it a perspective, not only for you, but obviously for a reading audience?
Well, I felt it was only fair that I, you know, examine myself and excavate the times of passage when I really had no idea what I was doing, when I was in disequilibrium, when my previous path didn't seem right anymore, when I gave up a love that I was cherished in order to write a book that I couldn't let go of, and that was when I separated from Clay Felker for 3 years to write Passages. It was really one of the most daring choices I made, but our magnetism and our respect for one another lasted those 3 years, and we ultimately married and started a second family and lived 25 years as a married couple. So I'm pointing out that daring isn't always successful, and I took some dumb dares. I wrote about how I eloped from college after 3 weeks with what I called my mother and told her I was eloping with a surgeon. She said, are you talking about McCarthy? Well, yes. And she said, he's a tree surgeon. So it didn't really work out as the great romance of my life, and I was able to be taken back into school and become what I used to call, laughingly, a born-again virgin.
But it is one of those things where the daring is there from the very beginning, and yes, you learn from those mistakes, but the fact is that you did learn from those mistakes, and there's a maturity, and that daring continues that allows you to become who you've become.
Well, you know what happens with it, Joe, is you dare, and when you actually, you know, get across the river without drowning, you realize you didn't die from it if you failed. If you failed at mastering something that you tried, then you could try it again, or you try something else. But the main thing is to fail and fail early. And today, failing is really the default position for people who are trying to do new things, particularly with the Internet. They try this and that and the other, then they get new partners and they try again, and something wonderful happens. And, of course, it's very important to have partners. Mentor is a great thing, but also partners who may help you launch a new business or a new idea. It's much more difficult to do something solo. And now we're finding out that even the most famous and brilliant people like Einstein or John Lennon had partners who were instrumental in the kind of work and breakthroughs that they made.
You mentioned a moment ago when you were talking about as you turn 70 to say that now is the time. Do you think that is a good time to reflect? Is that a good time to look back and say, okay, this is what I have done, this is where I have dared, and this is what I have accomplished in my life?
And also, this is what I most value. these are the things that were have been most important to me about my life and about my relationships. And yes, I do think the 70s is an ideal time to write a memoir, and even if you're just writing it for your family or for your grandchildren, what a treasure for them to be able to read this when they're old enough to appreciate what Grandma contended with and learn history from what she went through. So I highly recommend it. It's painful, but it's also illuminating. And ultimately, I think it helps you to come to terms with things that were disappointing or guilt that you've been carrying for a long time and give a blessing to your own life.
You write about your parents in the book. You write about your childhood, and it was one of those things where you really didn't come to full terms or an understanding of the complexities of your parents' relationship until you were really married and out of the house.
That's right. I didn't know that my mother was really a secret alcoholic. I suspected that my father was having affairs all the time. But I didn't understand that my mother had just been suppressed in her talents and her natural acumen to be a businesswoman by my father not wanting to have a woman who would work and make him look bad. And I didn't understand that my father, who was very helpful to me and encouraging when I was a child about writing, but once I became a professional, he never read a word of anything that I wrote. And my sister finally pointed it out to me when I gave her the first chapter of my memoir, and she said, "Well, don't you know why? You were more successful than our father."
And you are a young woman, you are married, you have a child, and you are also really caring for your sister at this point.
Well, she was 9 years younger than I, so she was right in the middle of the great drug craze. And living on the Lower East Side, amphetamine was all over the place, and she fell under the spell of a man who was attracting a cult of speed users. And I had to rescue her. She even got caught passing phony credit cards and got put in the notorious Women's House of Detention. So I had to go to plead before a judge to have her released in my custody. And the very funniest part of it was when the man who was her, the kind of devil master who was controlling her, came to look for me to find her and made an attempt to kill me. The only thing I could think to do was to grab my sister from a drug program I found for her and just get out of town, as far out of town and into a big crowd so he couldn't find us. And where did we go? Well, I heard about this. There was some kind of big event going on in upstate New York, someplace called Woodstock. So we got in the car. We got ourselves lost in tens of thousands of cars and finally ended up in the mud. We're in the biggest drug fest in the history of the world, and we were the only two people who were totally clean. We didn't even have a puff.
You were married for 5 years to your first husband, ultimately supporting him while he went through medical school. The marriage fell apart, and your next step you knew wanted to be what?
Well, I wanted to continue writing for the New York Herald Tribune and for Clay Felker. I had a dream job. But I also had a 2.5-year-old child for whom I was responsible. And I wanted to be with her while she was growing up. And I couldn't afford decent babysitters, so I gave up my job and began trying to be a freelancer when I was really only, 28 years old. Much too early. Didn't know if anybody would take me seriously, but I got an assignment from Cosmopolitan and went off and wrote about flight attendants, and they were downed in a flu epidemic, and I got to hang out in Paris for a couple of days until they came back. So lots of adventures happened, and I wrote a book when I was 30 called Love Sounds, a novel. So even though that was not a success because it was a little ahead of its time, it kind of reflected the new feminist wave, and it got slammed for that. But I learned that, again, I didn't die from the failure of my first novel. I learned how to write. I just decided I'd never write a novel again. I'd write nonfiction.
You went to speak to Clay Felker, really without the permission of your editor.
Oh, no. That was my first break, and I took the risk of being fired. I was working for the Women's Department, a very famous editor, and Clay was in the city room, which I called the testosterone zone.
Right.
I sneaked down the back stairs and crossed into the zone where I passed Tom Wolfe and Jimmy Breslin and thought, why can't I write like they do? And I got to the door of Clay Felker and said, Mr. Felker, and he was on the phone. He had a huge voice. He said, he was talking to the Four Seasons, said, what do you mean you don't have my reservation? And I was really quaking. And he said, come on in. It's Clay. What do you have for me? I said, well, first he said, where did you come from? I said, the estrogen zone. So he laughed and he said, what do you have for me? I said, well, I have a story about dorky guys who rented a beach house on Fire Island and they want to attract beautiful women. So they've offered half price to beautiful women and they want them to attract more beautiful women to their beach blankets. He said, well, what are you trying to say? I said, well, they're having specimen viewing parties. And I said, he said, did you go to one? Yes, of course. He said, well, write that as a scene and we'll call it Flypaper People. And that was the beginning for me of jumping off the edge and starting to write new journalism.
That jumping off, and just what you said a moment ago, of why couldn't you do that? Why, as a woman, could you not write the type of stories that the Breslins and the Wolfs of the world were writing? Once you were given the freedom, how difficult was that for you to do?
It just seemed to be second nature, to tell you the truth, Joe. I mean, I when I was 5 months pregnant, I went around to 15 different maternity clinics and pretended to be an out-of-work waitress to see how I was treated. And I wrote a series that won an award. But it was written, you know, kind of like a diary. And later when I wrote Passages, it was a series of stories of people's lives and illuminated by a theory of the fact that we go through life stages. So I really didn't have any trouble doing new journalism. It was the most exciting thing, and I'm still inclined to write that way.
You have a chapter in the book called Seduction at the Algonquin. What you were both, you and Clay Felker, were both going through a divorce at this time. So
right.
So what happened? You were both at the right time, at the right place for each other.
Well, yes, we've both been really, really burned, and we were very wary about doing anything like getting married. And, of course, in the 70s, nobody was getting married. They were doing every kind of experiment you could imagine, or they were getting divorced. So there wasn't any social pressure. But right away, we sparked ideas. We just became natural, creative intimates from the beginning. And he wanted me to write for him. And actually, within weeks after that meeting, he burst into my Lower East Side walk-up and said, I want you to go cover Bobby Kennedy's presidential campaign. I said, Clay, I've never written a political story. He said, well, what do you know about politics? I said, well, my father's a country club Republican. My mother's a natural bomb-throwing Irish rebel, so I know politics. It's about arguing at the dinner table. He said, well, then you'll understand Bobby. I said, how can I possibly, he said, look, Gail, and this was good advice for any journalist, he said, no matter how many little stories you write and no matter how good they are, people won't remember them. Tackle a big story, one that everybody's talking about, but they don't know the why.
When you think about it, Passages is the biggest story, right? That is the biggest story, really, that you've ever encountered, right? I mean, because it's about all of us. It impacts
all of us,
men, women, everybody.
It's right.
And you couldn't, I mean, nobody could have imagined that the book would have struck the way it did.
No, certainly I didn't. I thought it would probably just kind of sink without a trace because as a psychiatrist who was trying to convince me to be his collaborator, said, nobody will take you seriously with this book. You're just a journalist. And that's what I feared. But the fact was that I started doing the book tour 3 weeks before the book was published, so before reviewers could get their hands on it. And it began to spark conversations all over the country. And those conversations began to sell books. And the more books were sold, the more people talked about it. And then gradually, even psychologists and psychotherapists and psychiatrists came around as people would bring, as patients would bring the book to them and say, hey, here's another way to understand my life. Let's talk about it from this point of view. And I began to build credibility in that professional community. And that was very, very satisfying.
That was 51%'s Joe Donahue speaking with Gail Sheehy about her memoir, Daring, My Passages. Now, for a different take on daring, we'll head to France, where it's dads who are daring when they're the ones who put their careers on hiatus to stay home with the kids. If one parent is to stay home with the children, it's usually the mother. Sarah Elzis meets one stay-at-home dad who finds he gets treated differently than stay-at-home moms.
It's midday, and Mark is at the elementary school around the corner from his apartment in Paris, waiting to pick up his 5-year-old son. He waits outside with the other parents doing the same thing. A teacher tells them when they can go inside. This would appear to be a usual scene, parents waiting for their kids. And for Mark, it is. He does this every day. And that, it turns out, is the unusual part. He says lots of dads come for the first day of school.
After I decrease and you don't see them anymore, I'm the one that come every morning and every evening, every day.
At home, his son washes his hands and gets ready to eat. Mark wasn't always doing this. For over 20 years, he worked full-time for a music and electronics distributor.
At the end, I joined the headquarters to be chief product buyer. It was a good job.
A good job. His wife, who works as a human resources consultant, quit her job when their son was born.
So at the time, who was making more money, you or her?
At this time, it was almost equal. Maybe a little more from her side, but she wanted to breastfeed and take care about him was really something she wanted.
3 years later, though, Mark's company was downsizing and he was offered a buyout.
They proposed a suitcase with some money, and I said, it's a moment for me.
Mark has an older son from a previous relationship and says he regrets not spending more time with him as he was growing up. So this was an opportunity to do it differently the second time around. His wife was ready to go back to work, and because they could afford to have only one of them working, it seemed logical that he would stay home and take care of their son. Logical, yes. Normal, no.
When a woman don't work for the same reason, everybody finds it normal. And when a man does that, everybody finds it strange.
In France, elementary school is called école maternelle, maternal school. Everything having to do with children skews female, something Mark fully accepts.
When I go with my kid with a class for exhibitions, stuff like that, I don't mind if they say, moms, come by here, I'm a mom or dad.
He's a mom or a dad, but online, he's a dad. He started a blog last year called PAF, le PAF. PAF is a père au foyer, or stay-at-home dad. He started blogging just with basic animations, but he realized people were commenting. Once he was at home full-time, he says he was drawn to the interaction.
When you quit your job for a man or a woman and you're at home, I think it creates a big gap of social life, and the blog quickly became the solution for me to have a social life, to discuss with people.
And the blog has evolved into a regular log of his life as a stay-at-home dad, with photos of school outings, articles about his son's difficult eating habits, and his wife, whom he calls MQB, Mère qui bosse, Mother Who Works. On the blog, she's someone who's hyper-aware of her son's health and safety. And Mark admits that when he took over the parenting full-time, the differences in their parenting styles became very apparent.
We don't do things in the same way.
He's more laid back, and as a result, he says she's had to learn to step back and trust him.
Me, I let him fall. I let him reasonably try everything. She's a kind of mother saying, be careful, be careful, be careful, be careful. So I think since 2 years, my kid is more confident because I let him do many things.
His son describes a board game he's playing in the living room. Mark says he has no regrets about staying home with him, but people around him have questioned his decision.
Even open-minded people say, aren't you afraid that will kill your career? Do you think that you give a good image to your kids? Questions they wouldn't ask to a woman in the same position.
Of course, his answers to these questions is a contented air of self-confidence.
I have nothing to explain to anybody or to justify. I choose my life and I'm really happy of that.
Sarah Elzis, RFI, Paris.
Sarah Elzis also produced the story for Radio France International. Gilles Malkin has an edition of Women in History. This week, he profiles a woman who, depending upon your beliefs, is the ultimate in firsts.
Of all the women throughout history, none has been so revered and yet held so accountable for the sorry state of humanity as Eve. Real or mythical, no other woman has so influenced thought about or created controversy about her gender. But she's been so vehemently vilified for a little misbehavior that I've come to regard her as more sinned against than sinner. There are, heaven knows, many worse sins than disobedience. War, avarice, slavery, atonal music. The list goes on. In contrast, disobedience, curiosity, respect for reptiles, these traits may often be deemed as desirable, depending upon circumstance. And if we owe them all to Eve, well, I, for one, am grateful. What's of primary interest to me in the question of whether or not her shopping for apples was really to blame for all of the ills that haunt our species, or whether she was unjustly maligned, is the fact that her thirst for knowledge is called a weakness. Isn't it fascinating that all the greatest male minds in history have put the quest for higher knowledge and enlightenment above all else, because of its potential to lift us from the mire? Yet I hear none of them giving credit to Eve. Instead, she bears the brunt for all our ills, for reaching up toward God to taste his most precious treasure, knowledge, as he must have known she would. And from her fervent, blind, and innocent love for Adam, to whom she saw fit to make it a gift. And another thing. Putting aside the matter of the veracity of the story for a moment, I have a real problem with the details of who was made from whom. Something just isn't right. If God wanted to start a self-perpetuating species, why would he have started with Adam, a model that couldn't reproduce? For that reason alone, it makes a lot more sense that he would have made Eve first. Then he could procrastinate thinking of a way to make her multiply and gone back to rolling his dice. So pretty soon, maybe she needed some firewood. She had a mental lapse and said, "Hey, God, I could use a little help down here, okay? Something. Doesn't have to be perfect. Doesn't even have to have a brain, really." If indeed she made that boo-boo, as bad as it was, to me it's just as forgivable as the apple thing, as it was just another instance of innocently succumbing to the quest for higher education. Take a look around. I think if God had made man first, he would have been so discouraged that he would have given up right away. The only counter I can think of to that is that God supposedly made us in his image, and we never learn. This may also explain the idea that God, although it's not in the story, continued making other men and women, and that Adam was the first but not the only one he tried out. After all, Adam's sons married daughters of other unidentified couples. But I digress. Eve didn't spoil everything. Far from it. One part of her original state did survive. We all pass into new innocence whenever love takes us in its arms. So let's give Eve a break, and thank her for fulfilling what must have been his purpose, albeit, let's say, prematurely. And if we have to look back upon her as we continue groping our way blindly into an unknown future, let's do it thankfully for all the gifts and joys she made humanity's legacy to help us on our long and arduous journey to God knows where. Thank you for listening. For 51% and Women in History, I'm Gilles Malkin.
Writer, composer, and actor Gilles Malkin is a resident of the Catskills region of New York. And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Chartoff. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again or visit the 51% archives, go to our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1323.